ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
The extent and variety of life on Earth are astounding. What makes our home in the cosmos such an exquisitely suited habitat for the wondrous creation we see around us? Hello, I'm Eric Anderson, and today I'm pleased to be joined again by Dr. Eric Hedin as we continue our discussion of his brand new book, Cancelled Science: What Some Atheists Don't Want You to See. Dr. Hedin earned his PhD in experimental plasma physics and has taught physics and astronomy at Taylor University and Ball State University in Indiana, and at Biola University in Southern California. His research has focused on computational nanoelectronics and higher dimensional physics. Welcome back, Eric.
Thanks, Eric. Always great to be with you.
Last time we discussed the origin of the universe and some of the parameters of physics and chemistry that seem intricately suited for life as we know it. Today, I'd like to bring the conversation a little closer to home, so to speak, zooming in maybe from the vast reaches of the universe to our own planetary home. So first, let's zoom into the galaxy level. What kind of galaxy do we find ourselves in?
I think this is a good approach to take. Our home is within the Milky Way galaxy, which is a spiral type galaxy. And of all the different types of galaxies in the universe, which include ellipticals and irregular galaxies, as well as spiral galaxies, the spiral galaxies are the most favorable for sustaining life.
In Chapter 6, you take us on a whirlwind journey through the particulars of the life cycle of stars. I encourage listeners to check this out for lots of wonderful detail. But just briefly, though, you mentioned the importance of supernova for the formation of the heavier elements required for life and for a rocky planet like Earth. However, supernova also pose a risk to life. So now let's zoom into our particular position within the Milky Way galaxy. Why is our position in the galaxy well suited for us?
Well, the Milky Way galaxy, first of all, is an enormous structure containing at least 100 billion stars. And it is roughly a flat-shaped spiral galaxy with a nuclear bulge. The solar system in which we live is positioned within the Milky Way about two-thirds of the way out to the edge from the center. And this is a particularly well-suited location. It is right in the middle of what's known as the galactic habitable zone. A habitable zone because it's a region where life could be sustained around a planet for a long period of time. So what's wrong with the rest of the galaxy? Why might too close to the center or too close to the edge not be conducive for sustaining life? And it has a lot to do with these supernova explosions that were mentioned. You may have heard of these. A supernova explosion is the end of life event, the explosive event of a massive star. Massive stars create, by nuclear fusion, down in their cores, many of the heavier elements, heavier than hydrogen and helium, that are required for life and for building up a planet like Earth. But just think, if these massive stars produce these elements through their fusion energy process throughout their life, and then imagine that the star just ran out of fuel and just grew dim and dark and cold. What then? Well, we'd have all these elements forever locked up deep down in the cores of a massive star, where they would do absolutely no good whatsoever for, say, creating a new planet or for being available for anything that we need for life. So I find it to be a remarkable set of, I guess you could say, physical laws or principles or the design of the Creator that at the end of these massive stars' life, they explode in what's known as a supernova explosion, and the explosion allows them to spread these heavier elements throughout interstellar space. And then subsequent generations of stars that will form by gravity coalescing the gases of interstellar space down to a dense form, which would be a new star and even planets, they will include these heavier elements so that Earth, for example, contains this cornucopia of the right mix of all 92 or 94 naturally occurring elements. And there is this bit of a double-edged sword, though, to the supernova explosions. We need enough of them to enrich the interstellar media to to be able to get the right mix of heavy elements to have an Earth-like planet. But supernovas themselves are enormously powerful explosive events that are inimical to life, that are dangerous. They put out huge amounts of radiation. One supernova could shine as brightly as an entire galaxy of stars put together. So we need these supernovas early on in the history of the universe to enrich the interstellar medium with heavy elements, but we don't want them around much in the later period of time when life is on Earth because they're so dangerous. Well, it turns out that's where we are in our time frame of when life originated on Earth, but it's also where we are in terms of our location in the galaxy. There's a higher density of stars, as much as a million times more stars per cubic light year in the inner core of the galaxy compared to out where we are. More stars means more supernovas, and it could be just be too much dangerous radiation for allowing life to exist on Earth in the long run.
Yeah, that's a measurement we don't hear too often, a cubic light year.
That's a big volume, believe me.
Yeah. Okay, so we're in the right kind of galaxy, in the right general location in our galaxy. Now let's go ahead and zoom into our solar system. Tell us about our sun. It's certainly not unique in the galaxy, of course, but there seems to be kind of a widespread common perception that, as Carl Sagan once said, the sun is just a, quote, ordinary star. Is it true that single stars like our sun are the most common in the galaxy?
Well, not exactly. Our star is a single star, and maybe some of our listeners aren't aware of this, that in fact, at least 50% of all the stars out there in the galaxy are in what are called binary systems, where there's two stars orbiting each other and not just a single star. Now, if you have a binary star system with two stars orbiting each other, it's very difficult for a planet to find a stable orbit around one or both of those stars. And so it's not likely that a binary star system would be compatible with sustaining life on a planet like Earth over the long run. So we need a single star, and that already eliminates 50% or more of all the stars in the galaxy. But if I could just continue a bit about, is our star, our sun, just an ordinary star, which makes it sound like, oh, the universe is full of stars just like our sun. Well, again, that's not completely the case. Stars like our sun are not the most common. The most common ones are these smaller stars, which we mentioned last time, have the problem that if you have a small star, it's not as hot. You have to have the planet orbit closer to get enough heat to keep, say, water from freezing all the time. And if you orbit too close, you enter into this zone where tidal locking takes place. So these smaller stars are the most common by far in the universe. And then our sun is not like the biggest star either. There are much more massive stars. They become much more uncommon. So the only thing that's maybe ordinary about our star is that it's not the smallest and not the biggest. It's somewhere in between. But it is a particularly ideal star for sustaining life. It has a very stable burning. The nuclear fusion burning process going on in its core means that our sun is particularly stable in its energy or luminosity output. And that's essential. We on Earth cannot tolerate much variation in our star. I'm teaching astronomy right now, and we're just in the chapter dealing with our sun. And it's amazing when you look at the sun close up, like through a telescope, looking at the sun with the appropriate filters, you see that the sun is a violent, boiling, seething cauldron. It's actually rather scary. And yet you can walk outside at most places on Earth for a lot of the year, and it's just the right temperature. You know, it's shirt sleeves weather a lot of times, say in Southern California. And yet, why is it just so ideal? Well, it has to do with the placement of planet Earth at the right distance from our star. And it has to do with the star itself being of the right type so that there's not too much ultraviolet light. It's not too disruptive with solar flares or other changes in its luminosity so that we can day after day expect the sun to be constant in its solar output, keeping life on Earth just right.
Yeah, that's great. And you mentioned looking at the sun through a telescope. Don't try this at home, kids, unless you've got the right equipment.
Right, need the special filters to keep from damaging your eyes with that.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. I've got a solar filter here at home for my telescope, and it's been kind of fun to go out and look at the sunspots every once in a while and kind of track them as they go across the surface of the sun.
Right. So that's great. That's pretty neat. I just wanted to mention one more thing. If our sun were just 40% larger than it is, in the sense of 40% more massive, you think, well, 40% more massive, that can't make too much of a difference. Well, it does in astronomy, because the lifespan of a star is inversely proportional to its mass. So if our sun were just 40% more massive than it is, its lifespan as a so-called main sequence star would already be finished, and so would life on Earth. So we can't have had a star that's much bigger than our sun, because, I mean, think about it. Who would want life on Earth to already be finished?
Yeah. Well, that's really great information about our sun. Now let's consider the planets. For years, I used to get on NASA's exoplanet website almost every day to check out the latest news and see if there were any new exoplanet discoveries. Since the first news-breaking discovery of an exoplanet in 1995, there's been an explosion of these extrasolar planets. Just a few at first, then several hundred, now more than 4,000, and thousands of additional candidates being pinned down. One of the arguments, Eric, that we used to hear years ago about our solar system is that it was typical. Also, we only have a sample size of one, some people argued, so we can't say there's anything special about our solar system. The fact that you have a rocky planet in the habitable zone in a nearly circular orbit with larger outer gas giants was kind of taken as ho-hum. That's just a typical way solar systems form, the argument went. Now, obviously, we're still just barely scratching the surface, and there's so much yet to be discovered, but how has the discovery of now what amounts to thousands of other planetary systems shed some light on the habitability of our own solar system?
Well, thank you, Eric. That's a great question. And the whole discovery of extrasolar planets is a fascinating discovery. It was anticipated that there, of course, were other planets around other stars, but the technology just didn't exist to confirm their existence until the 1990s. And yet, what we have learned in our observations of these extrasolar planets, and by the way, just again to clarify, we're not really using big telescopes to just visually see these planets orbiting around distant stars. They're just too far away for us to be able to do that. So we use methods of indirect detection to infer their existence. And I won't get into the details of that, but we can still, with these indirect detection methods, learn some things about the planets. We can usually discover their mass, say, compared to how massive Earth is or one of our solar system planets. We can usually discover how far away from their host star they are in their orbits. And what we have learned from most of our discoveries is that a lot of these solar systems, these extrasolar systems, have very massive planets, sometimes more massive than Jupiter, orbiting very close to their host star, sometimes closer than the closest planet in our own solar system, Mercury. And so a lot of these other star systems with planets do not really resemble our own solar system very much at all. Now, part of this, the reason for this type of observation, is a selection effect. The methods that we use to indirectly infer the existence of planets work better to find massive planets orbiting close to their host stars. So that's what we find.
Right.
Mostly massive planets orbiting close to their host stars. But even if you kind of take into account this so-called selection bias, it seems that there are more of these than we would have expected if we had just been observing this sample size of one, namely our own solar system. And if we had a solar system that was more like what we have been observing elsewhere, I don't think that we would be here. Having massive planets close to the star would preclude a stable orbit of a very small planet like Earth, small in comparison, orbiting in the so-called habitable zone. And by the way, I'm not sure we explained entirely what a habitable zone is for orbiting a certain distance from the sun.
Yeah. Go ahead and tell us a little bit about that habitable zone. I know in popular parlance, some people call it the Goldilocks zone, but habitable zone is the more technical term. But yeah, tell us about that.
Yes, it's a zone, a certain distance. There's a minimum distance from the star and a maximum distance from the star where a planet orbiting within that zone will receive just the right amount of warmth from the star to maintain liquid water on its surface. And scientists believe that liquid water is essential for the development of life and the maintenance of life. So if you're too far away, it's just too cold, you don't have liquid water. If you're too close to the star, it's too hot, the sun's or the star's heat would simply vaporize all the water and you wouldn't have it in the liquid phase.
Yeah, that's not NASA's big mantra right now in terms of their the work that they're trying to do is follow the water.
Yes, and it really seems to make sense. It's perhaps conceivable that some form of simple life could maintain itself outside of that habitable zone, but almost certainly if you're going to have life such as we have on Earth, we need liquid water. And so our Earth happens to be in the right place in this habitable zone. And it's the only planet in our solar system that does exist within this zone.
Yeah. And some of these other extrasolar systems that we have observed also have far more elliptical orbits. And so there's that factor as well. I mean, some of them are very close to circular, but it's not the case that, gee, if you have planets forming around a sun, that you're going to have rocky planets in close, stable, circular orbits, right?
That's right, based on our studies so far. And granted, you know, 4,000 extrasolar planets, that sounds like a lot. Well, it's a lot more than we had in, say, 1980,
with
any evidence back then. But it's still a small number of planets compared to the probable total number of planets within the entire galaxy.
Sure.
So there are ongoing studies, but honestly, in this brief interview discussion, we can't go into all of the details that make Earth a special place. I mean, just being at the right distance from the sun and perhaps having the right chemical makeup, that's just scratching the surface of all of the features of Earth, which make it ideal for sustaining life over the long run.
Well, tell us, we've got time, Eric, as we wrap up here to dive into a couple of those. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the moon, the axial tilt, maybe a couple of these kinds of things that help to make Earth a special habitable place?
Sure. You mentioned the moon, and our moon is unique within our solar system. It's particularly large compared to the mass of our planet. There are larger moons, say around Jupiter and Saturn, but compared to the mass of those planets, their moons are not particularly large. Our large moon is very useful for helping to keep our climate stable, because the interaction between the moon's gravity and the Earth helps to stabilize the rotational axis tilt of planet Earth. And one of the first things that astronomy students typically learn is that the tilt of our rotational axis is primarily responsible for our seasonal variations on the planet. When the tilt is tilted towards the sun, the rotational axis is tilted towards the sun. That gives summer in the hemisphere that's pointed towards the sun, and opposite when the rotational axis is tilted away from the sun, it gives winter in that hemisphere. So you want to have a small tilt of the rotational axis so that a greater fraction of the entire planet's surface ends up with moderate temperature and not just extreme temperature variations. But without our moon's gravitational interaction to stabilize the rotational axis tilt, computer modeling suggests that the rotational axis tilt could vary widely from, say, 0 degrees to 90 degrees over the course of millions of years. And either of those variations would be destructive for our climate. You know, we think about a little bit of a concern over global warming currently. That would be nothing compared to what would happen if our rotational axis tilted over, say, to close to 90 degrees. It would cause one side of the planet to be just baked and the other side to freeze for months and months at a time.
Yeah. And that's not just a purely hypothetical, right? Uranus is, what, at 98 degrees tilted
yes, completely over? Yes, one of the planets in our outer solar system has that almost 90 degree tipped over type of rotation, and it would be a completely destructive climate on the planet if it was to sustain life. So there are other planets in our solar system that have axial tilts similar to the Earth's, but again, it's predicted using computer modeling that those rotational axis tilts may not be stable the way they are over the long period of time that our solar system's been in existence.
That's interesting.
So keep a planet. Go ahead.
No, I was going to ask, because Mars has a similar axis tilt as to ours, but is some of the thinking that's changed over time and it may have had an impact on Mars?
Yes. Mars has a couple of moons, but they're very, very small compared to the planet and would not have sufficient gravity to be able to stabilize the rotational axis tilt of Mars.
Interesting.
That's right.
So, Eric, what's the take-home message? What are the implications of all these factors as we kind of zoom into the galaxy level and then the galactic habitable zone and the type of star and our location within the solar system and the right type of axial tilt? The moon that we have, what are the implications of all these factors for our planetary environment and the chance of our home forming by chance? Let's put it that way.
Well, it's somewhat difficult to put a level of probability or chance upon, say, the Earth forming the way it is. But what we can say is that the way it has formed is ideal for sustaining life over the long history of planet Earth. And so it is entirely consistent with design. If you would think of an intelligent designer wanting to create Earth in a way to be able to sustain not just simple life, but advanced life over long periods of time, Earth is ideal for that. And so I would say that what we have observed is completely consistent with the idea of design. And I would take it one step further and say that it's a better explanation to appeal to design than to simply say, it's just dumb luck.
Mm-hmm.
I actually heard one scientist years and years ago at the university where I was teaching, giving a guest lecture and explaining some of these fine tunings of the universe. And he just kind of leaned into the audience and he said, it's just dumb luck. And, you know, I don't think it really came across as a particularly valid explanation. And I don't believe that appealing to dumb luck is even a good way of doing science. So for me, the appearance of design is suggestive of design, and it makes sense that that's what, in fact, came about. That's why our universe is the way it is. That's why our Earth is the way it is. And so for myself, this is something that can bolster my faith that there is a designer, that we're not just here as a result of random luck or some accident.
Right. And as you have more and more of these factors that you talked about, and this is one of the things I love about the book, is you're kind of building the case as you go along, that you look at the universe and the parameters and the galaxy and the habitable zone there and the sun. And as you kind of build all these together, it becomes, as you say, maybe we can't put a stamp of probability on it and put a particular number on it, but it sure starts to look suspicious.
Yes, I would agree with that. Suspicious in the sense of pointing to some intention that intended to be here.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Eric, thank you for being with us today to help us understand more about our place in the galaxy and our solar system, and this rare alignment of so many of these factors that seem to point to Earth as being tailor-made for a habitable home for us.
It's my pleasure.
We've only had time to cover a sampling of the many threads of evidence found in this new book, evidence pointing toward purpose and design in the cosmos and in our own planetary habitat closer here at home. I encourage listeners to pick up a copy for yourself or for someone in your life who could benefit from this important message. You can find Canceled Science today in paperback or ebook format at online retailers like Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Until next time, for ID the Future, I'm Eric Anderson. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by Center for Science and Culture.